Shrink Wrap Radio number 495, In Search of the Divine Feminine, with Jungian analyst Anne Baring.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is British Jungian analyst Anne Baring, and we'll be discussing her work on mythology and a new vision of reality, along with the issues facing us at this crucial time of choice. For more information about Anne Baring, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is putting on a year-long online certification course in West African divination and counseling with Maladoma Somme, whom I interviewed on episode number 444. For information and sign up, go to jungplatform.com/courses. Anne Baring, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you. You're a distinguished Jungian analyst and author and co-author of 7 books, including The Myth of the Goddess, Evolution of an Image, The Mystic Vision, The Divine Feminine, Soul Power, An Agenda for a Conscious Humanity, and The Dream of the Cosmos, A Quest for the Soul. So that's really quite a list right there, and each of those books being very substantial. I understand that you've long been driven by a deep interest in the spiritual, mythological, shamanic, and artistic traditions of different cultures. But before we get into all that, let's take a step back and have you tell us something about when and how you first discovered Jung.
I discovered Jung because I was in a deep depression.
And really?
I'd had a friend who had a nervous breakdown. And so I talked to her and she said, why don't you go and see this psychiatrist who is a Jungian? And so I did.
How old were you at that time?
I was about 30.
Okay.
About 30 at the time. And that really introduced me to Jung, because he was a Jungian, and he gradually introduced me to Jung's ideas, and I began to read, etc. And then I was, later on, about 11 years later, I was asked to train as a Jungian analyst myself. And that's how it all started.
Wow. So what was it about Jung's work that really spoke to you? Was there a particular aspect that really touched you?
Yeah, because he was the only person in that field who was speaking about the spirit, the spiritual aspect of our lives, and the psyche, and the importance of the spirit within the psyche, really. That's what attracted me.
Yeah. And I wonder, as you look back over your career, I wonder if you have any sense of predestination, if you will. You know,
yes.
The Jungian idea that there's kind of a seed there that we are not only looking backward, but the psyche somehow can see ahead.
I think definitely, because I had a remarkable mother as a child, and she received channeled messages when I was only 11. So I was introduced to the idea of the spirit world very early on. And that kind of set the pattern. What those messages said was that the world had to wake up, because we were moving towards a catastrophe if we didn't. This was really before the bomb and the splitting of the atom and everything. So that started me off. And then I had a very good education. I traveled a great deal. But I was always looking for the spiritual dimension in whatever I was doing. In my travels, I went to the Far East, I went to India, and I studied the Indian philosophies and the great texts of their that particular culture. So I was steeped, really, in anything to do with the spiritual from very early age, from 25 on.
Uh-huh. And you've just anticipated two of the questions I was going to ask you, and that's fine. And I did see on your very rich website, where you've got so much material and so much depth, and you talk about your mother's channeling, a group of four women who were channeling infinite wisdom about the coming catastrophes. And so I had intended to ask you if I thought that might have had some impact on your development and your later interest in Jung. So.
Yeah, well, it did, really. It kind of led me to Jung, because at that time there was nothing really to offer the soul, unless you went to India. But in Western Europe, there was nothing. And so that was why I came to Jung with such excitement, because here at last was somebody who really understood not only the psyche, but the whole spiritual past of humanity, if you like, and saw the need for reconnecting the conscious mind with the depths that had been neglected and ignored for centuries, really.
Yes.
So that was exciting for me. And also, the reason I was depressed was that I couldn't find what to do. I didn't know what to do with my life. And I didn't know how to bring the knowledge that I had together with the kind of jobs that were available.
I can well understand that. I can really understand that, given the kind of person that you are, of such intensity and passion. And it was like a period of incubation, perhaps, of your egg waiting to break open.
Exactly, it was. Well, my egg is only broken open with my last book, The Dream of the Cosmos.
Yeah.
Because I could really look back. I'm now 84. I can look back over my whole life and see where it's been leading me, mm-hmm. and what my work was before I pass on.
Yes.
And my work has been to do entirely with the feminine archetype, really, trying to bring it back into consciousness.
Yes, yes. And we're going to be talking about that. Just before we move on, though, you mentioned your studies. Where did you study?
I studied at Oxford University. I was very fortunate to have an education there. I studied medieval history and Renaissance history. Those were my two great interests when I was around 18, 19, 20.
Wow. And other than Jung, who have been your primary influences, teachers, would you say?
I think really history, no particular teachers. I was familiar with Plato and Greek thought. But I was pretty ignorant, really, as you are when you're 20. You don't know a great deal about anything.
Well, I mean, as you went along later in life, were there certain figures, say, as you were becoming a Jungian, or as a young Jungian, if you could say young Jungian?
Yeah, there was one person. When I went to India, there was a man called Sri Ramana Maharshi.
Oh,
he'd
yes.
He'd actually died 2 years before I went there. But he was the other great influence on my life, because he asked everybody the question, or rather he said to everybody, ask yourself the question, who am I?
Yes.
So yes. That really went deep into the psyche. And so I began to say, well, who am I? What am I doing on this planet? What is my purpose here? What am I? All those questions. So he started all that off. So he was a very great influence on my life, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're going to be speaking soon at a dream conference, and we'll talk more about that later. But I'm wondering to what extent dreams have informed your personal life, your clinical work, and or your research.
Well, the story of my dreams is told in my book, The Dream of the Cosmos, because I had a series of awakening dreams that were very, very powerful. I haven't had anything like that since, really, in my 40s. And they were the dreams laid the foundation for the second half of my life. And I tell the story of those dreams in the book. There were two or three very, very powerful ones.
Can you share one or two of those with us here?
I can share the most important. Well, that, two, actually. In one, I was in a rocket going to the moon. And I arrived on the moon, and I saw that there was a huge structure, an iron structure like the Eiffel Tower, planted on the surface of the moon. And the whole area of the moon that I was on was completely desiccated. It was dead, completely dead. So there was just me, this dead landscape, and this structure like the Eiffel Tower. And so that dream gave me the image of what has happened to the feminine archetype, that it has this huge iron structure placed on top of it, as it were, when all the life around it was completely dying and dead. So that was the opening dream, really, the very important one.
Mm-hmm. And the second, now, how much work did you have to do on that dream to come to that understanding of it? Was it immediately apparent to you, or did it take some time?
No, it took, I was with Gerhard Adler at that time, who was one of the biographers of Jung, or rather one of the people who did his collective works. And he immediately said, this is a dream about the feminine and what's happened to it, and about this masculine male structure, iron structure on this moon. The moon has always been a symbol of the feminine.
Yes.
I didn't know that, but he told me that at the time when I had just begun. He said, have you got an opening dream, when I went to him for the first time? And that was the opening dream.
Yeah.
So after that, it took me many years to understand what the feminine was all about. But that was my opening of the door, if you like, to the second half of my life.
Yes.
And then after that, I had another dream, equally important or more important, which was really a vision of the goddess or of the feminine archetype itself. It was an amazing dream in which I found myself, if there's time to tell you,
There is time.
I found myself going across this field of corn, beautiful green corn, and my feet were skimming over the top of the corn, not really touching it, just skimming it. And I came to a deep valley with a great sort of net stretched across it for about a mile across it, which was held by two male guardian figures. And I was caught in this mesh, lying flat on my back, looking up at the cosmos, and I had this vision of this cosmic woman stretching from earth to sky, and naked she was, with long golden hair, and she had a great wheel in her abdomen. And she indicated that I was to look down at my body, and I saw that I had a similar wheel, but mine was not centered. It was too far to the left.
Mm.
She indicated that I was to center my wheel.
Wow.
So that was the message of that dream. And so I've spent the rest of my life centering my wheel.
Oh, that's a wonderful dream. A wonderful dream.
So that was a vision. It wasn't just a dream. It was a vision.
Uh-huh.
I was very lucky to be blessed with such a dream. Because, as I said, it altered my life. It gave me my life path, which was to serve the feminine, really. And here I am today, having written a book explaining what happened to it, two books, really, explaining what happened to it.
Yes.
And why we are in so great a need now of balancing the masculine with the feminine, or the feminine with the masculine, in our culture.
Yes, so why is it the sacred feminine and not just the archetypal feminine? In other words, is there any way in which your understanding of the feminine differs from how it's perceived within Jungian circles generally?
I think probably I would take it deeper, because what I've really discovered is that the whole cosmos is a sacred entity. It's conscious, it's alive, and we are part of it. So in that sense, the earth is also a sacred entity. So when you're talking of archetypes, you're talking about a pattern, but you're not talking about a principle. And I'm talking here about the feminine deity, if you like, that the mm-hmm. aspect of deity that's never been recognized.
Okay.
That's never been part of the patriarchal concept of deity.
Okay. Now, in your book, Soul Power, you take up our alienation from nature, from one another, and from our deepest selves. And in your view, how does this come to be? I think it's kind of hinted in what you said, but let's go from there.
I think it's come to be, not through any fault of its own, but I think it's come to be through patriarchal religion, which has separated God from nature. Nature has never been included within the concept of God. Although it has been in the concept of the mystics, but not in the teaching of the church. And so there's been this great gap, really, between God up in heaven and nature down below that has somehow fallen, contaminated by the sin of the fall. And I think that had a huge influence on the Western psyche.
What about the Virgin Mary? Some people sort of seem to elevate her to an aspect of the deity.
Well, she has, in fact, been elevated through two papal bulls of 1950 and 1954. She was elevated into the in the Haros Gamos, really, of being united with the male spirit in the... It's too complicated to go into, but it did happen in those two bulls that she was elevated. But before that, she was never part of the deity itself. She was an intercessor between man and God.
Mm-hmm. And so somehow, even from so far back, you know, of one or more thousands of years, things got set in motion that have led to many of the difficulties that we see today. In your website, you talk about what's going on in Islam, a very penetrating analysis. I don't know if we have time to go through that here, but maybe if you have a way to give us a capsule summary, because that's certainly one of the dominant things that's going on the planet now.
Well, I think the problem, not only Islam, but the problem with Christianity as well and Judaism, is that nature has never been sacred and the body has never been sacred. Therefore, we've been allowed, really, to destroy the body for 3,000 or 4,000 years without realizing that we're destroying something absolutely sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't fix the problem only with Islam. It goes back at least to the Crusades and to the expulsion of the Moors from Spain, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. That was the crucial date, 1492, with the expulsion of the Jews and the Moors, that really set the scene for what we're experiencing now, because Islam has never forgiven the Christians for what they did at that time, so long ago. And that is the root of the hatred and the antagonism, really, that's been built up following the invasion of Iraq, etc.
Yes, and then there's the split within Islam that you talk about very beautifully and in a non-blaming kind of way, but sort of understanding the depth of it.
Well, it's a terrible tragedy that since the 7th century, the Sunni and the Shia aspects of Islam have been full of hatred of each other, really, and competing with each other for power and killing each other for centuries. And so that is an absolute tragedy, and it's created a deep wound in the Muslim psyche, which needs healing. But it's that wound has been exacerbated by what the Christians have done. So, you know, we're all really responsible for what's happening now. We're really seeing the end of what we've done for 1,000 years or more. And we've somehow got to recognize that we did wrong at certain periods and apologize for it, if we're to get through this terrible mess in the Middle East, which is really getting worse and worse every minute.
Yeah, I think you're really courageous to talk about that. I think many people are just so frightened to, you know, by what's going on, to do anything that could possibly rock the boat.
Yes, well, I think as I've studied history a great deal, and as I've already also studied religion, I can see where the problems stem from, and I can see what the solution is, but how to actually bring it about, I have not got the slightest idea. So I just make my small contribution by showing that the human psyche is deeply wounded in the patriarchal psyche, all three religions, because they lack the feminine archetype, but because they haven't integrated the archetype which represents relationship. If you leave out relationship, you're left only with the will to power. And that's what we're seeing now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You call for a conscious humanity. And in my notes, I said, that seems like a very tall order. How might that come about? And I guess one way is writing a book and hoping people will read it, right?
Well, that's one way. But you've got an American philosopher called Ken Wilber.
Yes.
about him? Well, he says that if 10% of the world's population could wake up and develop their conscious awareness of what we need to move towards, that would be enough to shift the whole planet into a new level of consciousness. And he says we've already achieved 5%. Uh-huh. So we've got, which is 5% to go, and it's 700 million, I think, because as we're 7 billion, that would be 700 million people, of which 350 million have already woken up.
Wow, you're working out the math. You've got an English fellow whose name I'm blocking on, Rupert...
Rupert Sheldrake?
Yes, Rupert Sheldrake, the 100th monkey. So it's a similar idea, right?
Yeah, that's right. You're absolutely spot on there. Yeah, absolutely. Because it moves very quickly once enough people have got hold of the idea that what has to change, that we have to stop this killing and raping and murdering and suffering and move to a new level. And we have to get over the will to power. That's the biggest problem of all the big nations that are involved in this mess.
You know, in your latest book and on your website, you do take on these really big issues facing us today, such as Fukushima and the atrocities happening this moment in the Middle East that we alluded to. And our planet is in such crisis now. We seem to be on the edge of an abyss environmentally, politically, economically, spiritually, militarily, and the list goes on. What more can you tell us about the roots of this crisis? You've really been talking about them already, but what more can you add?
I think one of the roots is that we don't know who we really are, and we are cosmic beings. We're not just people planted on this planet for no reason. We have a role to play, and I don't think this has become part of the consciousness of humanity yet. The fact that we have to serve the planet, that's what we're here for, and also that we're part of the cosmos, which is a live entity. It's not just a dead mass of galaxies, etc., beautiful as they are, but they're not dead, they're conscious and alive. And if people on the planet, as a species, we could realize that we have a role to play, that we're not just put here for no reason, that we can connect with other dimensions, for instance, raise our consciousness to do that, I think a lot would change. But we're sunk in old patterns. We're absolutely stuck in old beliefs, old patterns of behavior, old concepts about what's right and wrong. We haven't gone nearly deep enough into what's really right and wrong. And what's really right is the preservation and service of life, and what's really wrong is destroying life, whether it's with atomic weapons or whether it's with nuclear reactors, which are incredibly dangerous, or whatever, really. We have to change our understanding of what we've been doing in our ignorance. It's not our fault. It's in our ignorance.
You know, I'm not sure how this relates to our discussion, but I want to mention it anyway. Is this discovery just this past week that Einstein's conjecture about gravitational waves has been proven, maybe too strong a word, but almost so, and that we're hearing a sound from a billion light years away, which they described as a chirp. And they said it sounded like Middle C. Where does all that fit into what you've been saying? I mean, it's kind of a remarkable thing.
I'm not a scientist, but I did do a course in unified physics a year ago with something called the Resonance Academy in Hawaii with a remarkable physicist called Nassim Haramein. And he has brought everything together to show that we live in a unified cosmos and that we're all connected at the deepest level through the, not the atomic level, but the most minute scale of atoms, way, way, way smaller than the atom. We're all connected, but we don't know it. We're all one. I don't know where Einstein's discovery fits in really with this, but I do know that if people could understand that we live in a unified cosmos and that they're part of this unbelievable whole, mysterious, marvelous, incredible whole, they might see things and themselves in a different way. They would be less focused on trying to struggle for power, to compete with each other, to do each other down, to win, to be victorious. All that rubbish could go. I'm speaking very strongly.
Yes, well, you do. You speak very strongly in all your writing as well, too. And, you know, it occurs to me as we talk here that maybe Einstein was, in a way, on the same page that you are in terms of being a contemplative in some way, to be able to go so deeply into his thought, his mind, everything that he knew, to grasp some of these relationships that were totally beyond any ability to observe at that time.
Yeah, well, I think he was. There's no doubt he was way ahead of his time. And he said, which I've quoted in several books, he said, "We've changed everything." No, since the splitting of the atom, he said, we've changed everything save our mode of thinking, and thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophes. Mm-hmm. That's the only quote I can remember of his, although there are many more, which showed that he did have this concept of a unified, really almost a divine entity, but he couldn't really say that at that time, in whenever it was, 1910 or 1920. He couldn't possibly have said it, even if he'd known it, in terms that other scientists would have accepted.
Well, we've reviewed some of the very difficult, and that's putting it very, very lightly, difficult things that we face, and it's hard not to go into despair. Are you at all hopeful for our survival, and if so, what gives you hope?
I have great hope in the human intelligence. I think that when we're up against a wall, we can find our way through. If we simply look into the depths of ourselves and ask what is really, really important about our life. So I do have hope. I also think, apparently, we're being raised from the third dimension into the fourth and the fifth. So something is actually happening that the cosmos is doing for us. So all we have to do is to tune in to that different way of thinking, and we can move into a whole different way of living on this planet. So I do have hope, most definitely.
What can you tell us about the fourth and fifth dimension?
Well, I can't tell you anything because I'm just about probably... I think what I'm trying to describe in my books is the thinking of the fourth dimension, because the third dimension is all about power games and struggles, and it's all about fear and lack and wanting to dominate in order to compensate for the fear. But if you can move into another way of thinking, into a way of trust and relationship with the cosmos, that really shifts everything. So that's another reason why I have hope, and that would be moving into the fourth and fifth dimension. We would develop new faculties, which we haven't yet evolved, but we're capable of evolving.
Uh-huh. Now, I understand that you're going to be one of the keynote presenters at the upcoming International Association for the Study of Dreams, or IASD, conference in the Netherlands this June. And I see that the title of your presentation will be Visionary Dreams and the Great Challenge of Our Times. And I guess that's what we've been talking about here. Is there anything else that you can tell us that maybe we haven't touched on that expands that topic a bit more?
Well, I think the importance of what I shall talk about at that conference is the importance of dreams and the importance of remembering and writing down our dreams, and also of bringing back the ancient Egyptian knowledge that has existed and which was passed on to the Greeks, like Parmenides, for instance, the pre-Socratic philosopher Parmenides. They went into states of incubation in which they connected with these interior dimensions of reality. So it's that we have to bring back into our culture, which is so superficial and so materialistic. We need to know that there are things that we haven't known, and we need to bring back into our consciousness.
Yes.
Ways of connecting with this other dimension.
Well,
so that's what we're talking about.
I've been keeping a dream journal myself for about, off and on, for about 35, 40 years. What's your own understanding of dreams? Why do we dream? What's the purpose?
I think they're like a bridge to the cosmos, because the more aware we are of what they are, the more articulate they become. Otherwise, they may just pass by and we don't notice what they're saying. We don't interpret what they're saying. But with a Jungian training, you do begin to interpret what they're saying. You pay attention more.
Yes.
And I think they really are a bridge to cosmic consciousness or cosmic reality. I would say that absolutely definitely.
Uh-huh.
And the ancient civilizations, such as the Egyptian one and the Greek one, and the Indian and the Chinese very early on, knew that. And we don't know it, and it's really necessary for us to recover that knowledge.
Do you have another book incubating inside you right now? Do you know?
No, that last one took me 20 years to write after the goddess.
Wow.
But I am writing a lot that I put onto my website, and I've just done a three-part series for a television series, which I hope somebody will take up, which is called Transforming the Pattern of Terrorism and War, or War and Terrorism. That's on my website. So the outline of that is what I would like to write about if anybody was kind enough to invite me to do this series with my friend Scylla Elworthy.
Yes, and I see that you have collaborated quite a bit with Andrew Harvey. And I know when I've done some interviews with Monica Wickman. I don't know if you know her, an American Jungian analyst. And I recall her raving about him, but I don't really know his work. What drew you to collaborate with him, and what can you tell us about that?
Oh, he was really like a soul friend that I met maybe 25 years ago. And we collaborated on two books together, The Mystic Vision and The Divine Feminine. He's always been a friend, and he did a wonderful interview with me, which is up on my website, in which he talked about the dream of the cosmos and what it means and how I came to do it and everything. And he's written many, many, many wonderful books himself. And he's also giving extraordinary courses on the Shift Network. Do you know the Shift Network?
I don't. No.
Well, this is something that's very, very important in America. It's wonderful because it's bringing together not only the wisdom of the indigenous people, it's bringing together mystics and activists like Andrew Harvey. It's bringing people like Jean Shinoda Bolen at this moment is giving a course on goddesses in every woman. It's a fantastic way of teaching people. And they've been doing this, I think, for 20 years maybe. I've done several courses with them and gained a lot from them, including one by Andrew Harvey on the Christ Path. So there's a huge amount. I think they're reaching several hundred thousand people with their website and their courses. And that's a lot of people.
Yeah, that's marvelous.
And all over the world, not only in America, but people like myself in England, people in Australia, people in India and China, everywhere really.
Well,
that's remarkable.
You must have a somewhat ambivalent relationship with technology, or toward technology.
Well, I do, because it takes a lot of energy learning how to do all this technology, which I have learned up to a point. But there's always something new, and even like communicating with you today, I was nervous because I didn't know that it would work. Luckily, it has.
Me too. I'm nervous every time. And but also, I mean, so many of the problems that we're confronting, you could lay at the foot of technology that maybe it's an expression of the wrong side of masculinity, if you will. But on the other hand, it creates the possibility for us to speak like this. It creates the possibility for the Shift Network and for you to get your ideas out to so many more people than ever would have been possible before.
Thing in life, it has its light side and its dark side, and
right.
the dark aspect of the web. But this business of communicating with people all over the world, I think, is absolutely wonderful, and it's that will shift things. Have you heard of an organization called Avaaz?
No, I don't think I have.
Well, it has 42 million members now, and it is an activist I don't know what to call it, like change.org. It's like it puts up incidents which are happening in the world which need everybody's sort of clicking on the thing to say that they want to sign a petition.
Mm-hmm.
They do a series of petitions, one a week usually, and with that they're really shifting people's opinion. They tackle things like, for instance, Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen at the moment and killing civilians. So they put up a petition saying, will you appeal to the European Union to stop the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia? It's that sort of thing.
Is it change.org, or it's an organization that's like that?
Avaaz.org. It's A-V-A-A-Z.
Okay. Yeah.
Avaaz. Okay. And I think it's absolutely brilliant. And with 42 million people, they have some clout.
Well, I'm going to write that down so I can...
Oh, they're listening.
I can add to the clout. one more clouter.
Yeah, it's called Avaaz.org.
Okay, Avaaz.org. And I've kind of run out of questions here.
Well, I think we've covered, I'm looking back on my website, I've covered nuclear weapons and the absolute abomination that they are. I've covered nuclear reactors, which are very, very dangerous. I've covered the channeled messages. I've covered this proposal for the TV series.
And you also had a document by a council of indigenous leaders, elders, which was very profound, I thought.
Yeah, well, they met in America about a year ago, I think, or 2 years ago, and I noticed what they said because I think I received it through the SHIFT network. And so I was able to get the gist of it and put it up on my website because I'm very, very impressed with what the indigenous peoples are doing for this planet because I think they have the right idea. And if we could really integrate their wisdom with our political agendas, it would shift everything enormously. And I learned that there were, I think, 250 Indian tribal members who were present at the formation of the American Constitution with Thomas Jefferson and who was the other one? Benjamin Franklin. And they helped to formulate the principles of the American Constitution. I never knew that.
I didn't know that either.
I only learned it about a month ago when, again, on the SHIFT network, I was listening to one of the indigenous speakers. I can't remember his name. And he told the story of that. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So it's that sort of thing. We need to bring together the wisdom of the indigenous peoples who've kept alive this relationship with the planet for 50,000 years at least, and recognize what they could offer us in the way of a different understanding of our presence on the planet.
Well, that may be a good sentence to wrap things up with here. So, Anne Baring, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
What a privilege it was for me to be able to speak to this 84-year-old Jungian visionary. Her life is a shining example of one driven by a deep inner sense of purpose. She has doggedly tracked the archetype of the sacred feminine throughout her life. I'm also struck by her courage to take on the biggest and most disturbing issues of our day. She really inspires us to look deeply into ourselves and to draw strength and wisdom from our own deepest wells and to recognize our profound connection to everything in the cosmos. Let me remind you that she will be a keynote presenter at the International Association for the Study of Dreams conference, which will be held in the Netherlands June 24th through June 28, 2016. You can find full information about the conference on the Shrink Wrap Radio website if you'll click on the banner ad in the left-hand sidebar, which will take you to their conference site. You heard how much and bearing prizes, the wisdom of our dreams. And at this conference, there will be many other stimulating presenters and opportunities to mingle with passionate dreamers from around the world. You can check out Ann Baring's very rich website at annbaring.com, and that's spelled A-N-N-E-B-A-R-I-N-G. As always, you can use the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar to purchase any of Ann Baring's books. I would particularly recommend her last one, inasmuch as it is the product of 20 years of work. That title is The Dream of the Cosmos, A Quest for the Soul, which incidentally was awarded the Scientific and Medical Network Book Prize for 2013.
Dr. Dave, this is Cindy Gozanski from Portland, Maine. I am a master's level psychotherapist, and I have chosen to support Shrink Wrap Radio financially because of the immense benefit that I get from your podcast. I am in private practice and an adjunct instructor for our graduate counseling program at University of Southern Maine, and find that your Shrink Wrap Radio guests and information is so helpful to me in both of these fields. Often, after I hear one of your guests, I purchase the book or go to their website and I'm able to really incorporate more of the amazing information, techniques, tips, and other things that are so useful that you provide. Again, I am so grateful for the wonderful features that Shrink Wrap Radio provides to all of the listeners, and especially the professional listeners like myself in the area. And I have shared Shrink Wrap Radio and will continue to do so with many of my students and colleagues. Once again, thank you so much, Dr. Dave, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Cindy Gorzanski up in Maine. And thank you for sharing Shrink Wrap Radio with your students and colleagues, and for your ongoing support. I hope others will feel similarly inspired. Unfortunately, there are no new donors to announce or new transcripts at this time. Let me remind you that the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar that you can use to order any books you wish, but not only books, but anything at Amazon. I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. I know my family does. If you'll use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code, and Shrink Wrap Radio will get a small percentage of the purchase. And it's another way that you can help to support us. Now just go to that widget in the right-hand sidebar, and where it would have you type in the title of a book that you're looking for, instead click on the black border at the bottom of that widget. That'll still take you to Amazon.com, but from there you can go to any category you wish, not just books. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, my recommendation today is a good fit with today's guest. You heard me mention Andrew Harvey as having co-authored several books with today's guest, Ann Baring. I also mentioned that my past guest, Jungian analyst Monica Wickman, had been studying with him. Well, it turns out that Andrew Harvey has several books on Audible.com, and I'm recommending this one, which is over 9 hours long. It's titled Radiant Heart, The Radical Teachings of Jesus and the Christian Mystics, and it's read by Andrew Harvey himself. Let me play you a sample.
The fiercely radiant account of a living relationship with the transfigured human being, Jesus Christ. Jesus, I believe, was not a God who came down to this dimension and breezed through it and left behind traces of his astonishing godhood, but far more challengingly, an extraordinary human being who flung himself into a amazing, dynamic, sometimes terrifying, and always extremely moving adventure of the spirit, which culminated in him merging with the force of love that creates the entire universe and becoming its face in human time, the face of the cosmic Christ. And those who undertake the journey into the depths of that realization that propelled the great adventure of Jesus are sustained in that adventure by the living presence, the living grace, the living bliss and power of the very force of love that creates the whole universe that now wears the face of the cosmic Christ. What I hope to do in the journey that we are now going to take together is to give you, as far as I am able, a complete account of what I believe to have been the thresholds and mysteries of Jesus' own mystical transformation on the earth and in the core of his amazing and dynamic life.
Well, I think you can see how congruent this is with what Ann Behring had to say. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if this one's not to your taste, they have more than 180,000 other titles for you to choose from. In fact, that number has probably gone up. I've been saying the same number now for some time.
This is Gloria Ullman from Adelaide in South Australia, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave, along with thousands of other listeners who have all been shrink-wrapped to fit on it.
I got a kick out of that one. Thank you, Gloria Ullman, who has transcribed so many of our episodes and who has committed to transcribe this one with Ann Behring, but who also has a great sense of humor as well. I'll read just one recent email from our listener community today, and it's from Wes, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I've listened to your program for a number of years now, and I want to thank you for the great guests you've had on your shows. If you could take in consideration some ideas for future shows, I think the shows would be very beneficial to other listeners and myself. Here is a small list of ideas for future programs. Hypnosis. Does it really work? For what issues or problems? Learned helplessness and motivation. How are they linked? What's the cure? Brain plasticity. How to change it for the better? What to stay away from? Mindfulness. Is it working or just an industry fad? How to find a qualified therapist with references? Newest non-drug treatments for ADD, ADHD. Thank you for your consideration. Sincerely, Wes from New York." Well, Wes, thanks for being a listener and for your excellent suggestions. They are good suggestions. Some of your suggested topics have been covered rather extensively, though, I think. And also, there is a search box in the upper right-hand corner on the site for you to explore some of those topics. I would suggest, for example, a search on mindfulness and one on meditation. Do another search on hypnosis, and I especially recommend number 50, Ericksonian Hypnosis and Solution-Oriented Therapy with Bill O'Hanlon. And neuroplasticity has been discussed a lot as well. Do a search on brain and another on neuroscience. At the same time, I'll keep your suggestions in mind as I move forward. So once again, I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Jungian analyst Ann Behring, for sharing her work on the divine feminine and the challenge to us all for the changes of consciousness required for global survival. My next guest will be Dutch Professor Emeritus Hubert Hermans, who is best known as the creator of dialogical self theory and who will also be a keynote speaker at the 2016 conference of the International Association for the Study of Dreams, which once again will be held in the Netherlands, June 24th through the 28th of 2016. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.